ፍቅር ነበር ለካ የሰው ልጅ ማንነቱን እንደ ሰው ሰውነቱን ድራቱን ጎልቶ ሚለካ ፍቅር ነበር ለካ
my jam of the week, Ornette Coleman, Chappaqua Suite, recorded in 1965 for Columbia, commissioned by Conrad Rooks as a soundtrack to his film called Chappaqua, but he decided not to use it after hearing it. Supposedly the story is because the music was so good, he was afraid it was going to take away from the mediocrity of his film. This is An Experiment with Time on WRCT. Rolling right along, we got some music from Ethiopia. This is Hailu Mergia. We'll be right back. Patrick Shiroshi off of his 2021 album Hidemi. That was a closing track called The Long Bright Dark. And before that, Stephen Malkmus from his 2019 Groove Denied Ocean of Revenge. That song holds a really fond place in my heart. I really remember very strongly flying back from getting on an airplane from Miami after a weekend at a EDM festival that I did not want to be at, and that coming on my headphones, and just what a breath of fresh air that song was to my ears. Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh. Take care of yourselves.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Well, I'm Richard Gordon.
I'm Riona Duncan.
And we'd like to welcome Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner to Forbes Avenue. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
Really happy to be here.
And we've invited you here because we want to have a conversation of sort of about a project you're both involved with, the Mad Women and the Attic Collective, mm-hmm. and the poetry scene in general here in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so my first question is, I wanted to know how Mad Women in the Attic kind of fits into the Pittsburgh art scene and poetry scene.
It's a very good question. Do you have something you want to say first?
I would say that we have a really wonderful poetry scene in Pittsburgh, literary art scene in Pittsburgh. And Mad Women is an integral part, honestly. There's just a fraction of the people within the scene who are part of the collective. However, that is very strong. Like, it's the kind of thing that is a jumping off point for a lot of people to begin their writing career, and then to sustain it, to grow it, and then get involved in many other projects. So I think it's really seminal to the scene here.
I mean, it's a broad, a very broad group. I mean, the people in the Mad Women range from ages 18 to 99, and it's all different levels of experience in each workshop. So there's all these workshops people can take, and so people come into the classes, and you know, you could find yourself in a workshop with people who have a couple books and somebody who's sitting in their very first workshop. And I find that a lot of people from other poetry groups around Pittsburgh also are part of the Mad Women.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty cool.
I didn't realize that there was a formal structure like that. Workshops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They are housed at Carlo University. And it's been, the Mad Women have been in existence since 79. And it's grown over the years. So there's, you know, multiple workshops that you could choose from, poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction. There's a mentorship program. And the group itself produces an anthology each year. So you get the Mad Women anthology, which showcases the work of everybody that they've been doing all year long.
How many people do you count in the collective?
I mean, hundreds. There's hundreds.
500.
Whoa!
Yeah.
I mean, not everybody is active in every workshop every time, but the Mad Women are... There are a lot of us.
Strong force. So. And that's how you refer to each other, usually Mads or Mad Women.
Mads,
like, if
Mads.
You're a Mad Woman, you're a Mad Woman for life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are some of the other collectives that are active in the Pittsburgh scene?
I mean, there are so many of them, I don't think I could possibly accurately describe them. There's, yeah. You know, they're like the more formal groups, like the Pittsburgh Poetry Exchange. And then there are spinoff workshops all over the city with people that are comprised of other groups, and they keep popping up. I mean, I feel like every time I turn around, there's a new group of people that are working together and maybe having readings or putting together publications.
Speaking of readings, the only two places I know of, because I've only been in Pittsburgh for 6 years, are Hemingway's and City of Asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Where else can people find readings from time to time?
Well, a really cool new series has just started back up again at a place called the Poetry Lounge in Millville, a venue itself. And then within that, they host a reading series or various types of readings. They do a lot of spoken word stuff. They do book launches. They do publication launches. So that's just, you could just go to like Millville Poetry Lounge, you know, Google them. You could find their website and they have a nice events calendar. There's the
bookstores. I mean, White Whale, they have a ton of readings at yeah. White Whale or Riverstone Books all around the city. Actually, Littsburg, yep. The website is a really good resource for finding out what's going on, when and where. Just a good place to check out to see what people are doing. Littsburg.org.
Yeah.
Littsburg.
It's a pretty comprehensive list of everything because to Lisa's point, there are so many.
Yeah.
It's really hard to keep everything in mind.
There's different kinds of writing and different ways to engage with it so everybody can find something that feels good to them.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner from the Mad Women in the Attic Poetry Collective. And I suppose before we go any further, you guys should each share some of your poetry. I know Michelle has got two lines of her poetry up on a bridge somewhere.
It was a rotating installation art project. So the lines they weren't permanently there. They were temporarily up. But the funny thing was, it was part of a commission through the Westmoreland Museum of Art, Westmoreland County Museum of Art. And it was with a collaboration with an artist named Janet Zweig. And it was supposed to scroll every month different lines of the poem. But then mine was up during COVID, And so the lines of my poem ended up being on the bridge for like 6 months and just stuck there. And I'm certain that everybody got really sick of them. So, but yes, it was a really cool project.
Well, which one of you wants to read something first?
I guess I will read something first.
Right, here comes Lisa Alexander.
Okay, so this poem, the thing to know is that the first line is also the title. Kids out the window, sound like goats. The sky gray like the lining of my pockets. Smells wet, like my McDonald's birthday party. How I loved the fryer, the behind the scenes, the candied grimace on my cake, too sweet but gritty between my teeth, which are rotting early, a constant ache in my mouth. A little guy with a pickaxe beneath my molars, heaving its point into my gums. He must be installing steel tracks inside my jawline for some subterranean city that will never be unearthed. When I smile, no one can see it. And it's likely that I'll never point this out to you. I'll just watch a woodpecker peck the awning outside my window without welcoming it into my mouth. I'll try not to worry about what's beneath your gum line, what hover-tracked universe you harbor inside your skull, and instead, I'll think about goats and how they kick everything over, and so would I if I could get away with it.
That's got a little bit of everything in it. I heard McDonald's birthday party, deep fryer, and goats.
Yep.
And goats.
Yep. Got some goats. Some cities, you know.
Well, tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, I'm not sure. It's like when I did have a McDonald's birthday party when I was a kid, and there was a candied grimace on my cake that I ate, and I remember the way it tasted. But I think for when I'm writing poetry, it's kind of like pulling a line, and that line is a thread, and then as I'm pulling that thread, it's changing colors, and so I'm trying to catch all the colors on the thread as it's changing. You know, like that's kind of how I think about poetry. I mean, it doesn't always come out like that. You know, sometimes I just pull it and it gets stuck and I'm like, now what? But this kind of came out like that. And I just kind of let myself leap with it, you know.
That's beautiful.
Michelle, you got something you want to share?
Sure.
Will I see this on our bridge?
No, this was in a journal called 5 a.m. many years ago. That was a great journal by the wonderful Ed O'Chester and Judith Fulmer that has since been retired. But this is a poem called Teens in the Strip Mines. Like quaaludes and poppies crushed in a rocks glass, sipped. The strips had colors like an oil spill. In that hollowed-out land of no vegetation, mud and clay, monoliths collapsing in on themselves, pliable, we'd sneak bottles of liquor and spend the night there. Jean, Emily, Don, and I, sometimes Lori, up through morning. We'd marvel at the cliffs with angles severe and bald, the scoured land, guess about the trees that used to be there, the vast forest, the rest of the world we wanted to see, so lush. Mountains topped and mined, pitted from the inside out, landsliding, we always went there in the rain. We decided this was a softened chocolate egg of a mountain, that a Dali arch we'd climb at sunrise, purples and rust smeared in the bedrock as we passed whiskey between us.
That sounds like a memory of something that actually may have happened.
Perhaps.
Their approaches are so different. Lisa, I feel like yours has got lots of the little details, and you're asking your audience to put them together. Mm. And Michelle, I felt like you had something you wanted to say.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you say that. I always have something I want to say. I was just told that in a meeting like an hour ago. I don't particularly want to write like agenda-driven poetry. For me, one of the things that I feel are my charge as an artist is the idea of, you know, taking maybe a mirror and reflecting back society or challenges or issues that we have in the world and reflecting it back. But you have to do it through your own lens. Like you have to indict yourself. I believe it for me personally, it needs to be connected to my own experience in order for it to be, you know, valid, for it to not co-opt someone else's experience. And so I write a lot about the area where I grew up, which was in Western Pennsylvania. And there was a lot of mountaintop removal, coal mines there. And so I've seen what happens afterward. And, you know, I'm concerned.
Also was interested that the poem talks about the characters going in there to allegedly drink whiskey.
Yeah.
But
allegedly.
I also think of that as, you know, families that have been in the mining industry for decades and decades, and where it's grandfathers and fathers and then teenage sons and daughters who start working in the mines.
Yeah. Mm.
So, I mean, I'm sure that was an intentional double whammy that I felt.
I'm glad you picked up on it. Yes. Certainly, I was trying to sort of, like, create a generational picture as well, like that this is the kind of thing that happens in a small town when industry leaves and you just kind of, like, you hang out in the dirt.
So we've heard a little bit about your creative processes, but I was wondering how your day jobs affect how you make art.
Well, it's twofold. I mean, one, the stress and responsibility can kind of really cut you down. Kind of sucks it all right out of you. For that part of it. But I work for Calliope, the Pittsburgh Folk Music Society, so my job revolves around music, which helps, I think. You know, I typically tend to, I try when I get up in the morning before the world gets at me to maybe read a little bit, stare out the window, maybe write a little bit. Nothing, I'm not like, you have to write every day or else your writing is going to fall apart and you're a terrible person or any of that kind of stuff. Not into that. Like, I got to ride with it however it comes. And so usually I try to write in the morning a little bit if I can. Sometimes it's just reading. But then I go into the day, and sometimes I get lucky enough for little bits of things that have happened throughout the day will fall into my lap as something I might be able to use.
You left out another day job.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm also an adjunct instructor at Carlo University, so I teach composition over there. So, you know, I spend a lot of time with words, other people's words. Keeping words and music in my head is the best way to keep the machine going, you know, whatever it is, you know. I find that music helps me write when I feel stuck. I listen to music. Reading helps me write when I feel stuck. I read. So as long as I'm keeping those things up there, sometimes I can't do any of that, and I just sit with the cat and stare out the window, and that's about all I can do. But when I'm lucky.
Yeah, it's a really important question because most people who make art have to have a day job, right? You're not going to get rich from your poetry. I think it's actually one of the bigger struggles is doing your best to preserve your creative headspace, right? And the way that jobs take up most of your mind and your headspace and your energy, it can be hard to carve out a compartment within your brain that you hold sort of sacrosanct for your creative process. To me, that really, truly has been what I've had to do over the years, is just figure out how to seal off a room that I only open up for art making. And that is, it takes a lot of different forms. Sometimes if I'm not feeling particularly heady in what I want to generate, I'll paint that day instead. Like, to Lisa's point, music is really important to me. Listening to music, catching a cool line will help inspire me, but also rhythmically. Meter is such a big part of poetry. Sound is really important to me in my work and in the stuff I like to read. And so sometimes I'll just go for a walk, like just to get the rhythm, you know, the thump, 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 thump. Almost always that starts it for me is I'll go for a walk first. I'll let some ideas percolate and then I'll hopefully write something. I think one of the keys is to not put too much pressure on yourself because you do have to make money. You do have to pay your bills, you know, and sometimes I think a lot of times artists are very good at flogging themselves, you know,
yeah.
It's just a general nature of ours. And so this is one more thing to flog yourself about is, right, I didn't dedicate time to writing today. And I think it comes and goes. And go ahead. Sorry.
Sometimes it's enough just to get to the end of the day.
Yeah. But I'm lucky enough that I have a day job where I get to engage in the arts being part of what I'm up to, too. So that helps.
You're on staff here at Carnegie Mellon University.
That turns out to be correct, yes. So I am a senior academic program manager in the Accelerate Leadership Center within the Tepper School. One among the many things that I do, one of the cool things that I've been able to get into is that I created a set of programs where we work to help develop the self-awareness and empathy and critical thinking of business students by exposing them to the arts and humanities.
Gee, sounds like when I was teaching ethics to computer science students.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? You're doing important work, sir.
As a humanities student right now, I say please get the business students in on it.
Yeah.
We are chatting with Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander, who just told you their other affiliations besides the one in the Mad Women in the Attic. political, poetic collective. I just love that name.
I was also going to ask, you talked about how rhythm and saying something is important to you, but also I wanted to know, how do you view the poetic use of language? Because language is so important when you're building a poem. I mean, it makes the difference between just writing prose and, you know, adding some imagery to it. So how do you focus on that?
It's a good question. I think... you know, when I'm writing a poem, I don't want to sound like I'm writing a poem. You know, like, I don't want it to feel forced. I don't want it to feel like the words are wearing a costume. Like, I'm trying to get as close to the humanness as I can. And sometimes I have to use the odd-shaped tools in the box to get there. So, you know, I'm doing whatever I can with the words to try to get as close to the way something tastes or smells or feels. And I'm just trying to get to the organic experience, whatever that is, and not, I don't want it to be perfect. I'm never trying to show, like, this is what it would be if it were perfect. I mean, there's a place for that, but, like, that usually that's not what comes out of me necessarily. So with the language, the use of language, I'm just trying to use whatever tools get it close to the way it actually feels or might feel if I'm poking at something.
Yeah, this is a great question. Like Lisa, I also have an additional job as an adjunct. I'm actually one of the poetry instructors within the Mad Women in the Attic Creative Writing Workshops. And one of the things that I always tell my students is, certainly you can write a prose poem, but even that is still a poem, right? It's not prose. It presents its own challenge, but then it also presents its own opportunity. Like, you get all of this extra, like, leverage to just leap around, be strange. It feels to me like it's such a it feels to me like it's such a wide open, free invitation to let the way that your own internal language or compass, the weirdness that your own brain makes, it's a chance to let that run free. There is no original idea under the sun, right? So the only thing that's original is how you approach the thing, the content that you want to write about or the image you want to write about or whatever it is, and push it through yourself. And the way that it comes out will be the original thing. And I think we're using language right now to express ourselves, right? So it gets tricky because everyone has the same toolbox. It's just a matter, I loved your analogy, Lisa, of which weird tools do you pull out to use. So, yeah.
Well, like you two, I had to be very precise in my use of language in my job as a tech writer.
Yeah.
And then as time passed on, I got to go into sort of the business that Lisa's been in lately of writing PR pieces, mm-hmm. looking for the right adjective, yeah. you know, to set up all sorts of feelings around things. Mm-hmm. There are times when you want to be precise, and there are times when you want to use language that builds on emotion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, an image does a lot of that work, too, you know. I don't know, I have in my head the idea of, like, a giant moon just sitting in the middle of a line of words and just spilling its moon pool all over the sentence. You know, like, I don't know. Do with that what you will, but I mean, you know, image does a lot of lifting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what No Ideas But In Things is about.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah.
That's what my poetry professor was telling me this year.
Awesome.
You know, I think we have time. Why don't you each share another poem with us?
Okay. Cool. Iris the Mechanic. You sit around with your head on and look out the window to watch whatever is falling from the sky, and hope whatever song plays next is one you can take off on. The sun, you know, is at your eyes. You see it instead with your brain. Your iris, the mechanic, parceling light into your pupils And doesn't this sound familiar? Or is that just hope again, talking itself into thinking some sense can be found somewhere to soothe the general state of unhinge that persists no matter how hard you slam the door or even close it gently like a responsible person? Still, it slips ajar, allowing light to angle across your face, even when you close your eyes to avoid it and dip into something quieter and perhaps less sonically loud. But this iris, mechanic, formed within your sockets without you even thinking about it, and it serves you by allowing infinite and impossibly old movement inside your face, for a time, anyway.
I love that poem.
Thank you.
I'm left speechless by that poem, which doesn't work on the radio.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, that's a tough act to follow.
I don't know.
Where did that one come from?
It came out of my head. It fell out of my head.
Well, I know it fell out of your head. It was moon falling over the paper. But
yeah, I don't know. I mean,
did you know an iris, a mechanic?
I did not. No, I just sometimes science makes its way into my poems, and I like science. I like to read about that science. I've failed all science that I've ever taken in my life, but I really like to read about it. And sciencey things kind of make it in, and I'm always kind of, I just feel like existence is inexplicable, and sometimes that makes it onto the page.
Michelle has found something, it looks like.
I think so. Well, it's an interesting kind of like counter, or not even, it's a companion point to what you were just saying, I think. This fell out of my head the title is The Universe Completely. So that's a big concept, right? But it actually takes that and makes it very small and specific to the speaker in the poem. So The Universe Completely. I like days like this. Thunder in the clouds, us on the ground. Makes me feel like I'm getting away with something. Getting away, and it's cool with the windows open. Not cold today. I think the place is going to explode, all charged. This, to me, is here as the universe completely.
I almost feel, Michelle, like the two poems you shared with us are they take a certain rhetorical stance to the world. When you think about all the different uses of poetic language, I think of things like, you know, French imagiste poetry and real haiku, where you've got images without any explanation, and you're supposed to glean something from that. Or, you know, William Carlos Williams. What I'm getting at is you think of poetic language that way, but you also look back and you see that if you go back far enough, you see that poetic language also has a rhetorical structure, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you look at so much of Shakespeare's poetry that the two of us, Riona and I, have talked about.
Yeah.
Where there's a rhetorical stance in those sonnets, in your poems. There's a rhetorical point of view. It's different than in classical poetry.
Sure.
But there's a rhetorical view where there's a viewpoint. Uh-huh. Lisa's poetry, I feel I'm being presented with these images and being challenged to react to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's very insightful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's a point of view as well, because you're letting your reader fill in the blanks, mm-hmm. and assuming they'll do it well enough, or at least kindly enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think there's trust in that, right? That you're really trusting your reader to come along with you on the journey, and that you know that they're showing up to read poems to do the hard work of reading poems, right?
Yeah, that trusting your reader is a tricky thing.
Trusting your reader to read and savor slowly, mm-hmm. as opposed to speed read to get through it.
Mm-hmm. Or leave room, you know, like leave room for what they don't know or don't understand, or, you know, maybe repelled by, you know, like trusting them to sit with it. Because ultimately, I think poetry is just about capturing all the real pieces, whatever, we're doing the best to catch all the real pieces, which in my mind are like little bunnies all over the place and just trying to catch one and take its picture, kind of, you know.
This is really fun talking with Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner about poetry. You know, I feel the age dropping off of me. But I have sort of a mean question I got to ask.
Do
that
it.
Is, how can poetry survive in our current media market? You know, we've got, how can poetry be heard when we've got fast hot takes and YouTube and TikTok and Instagram?
hundreds of cable channels, and don't forget AI-generated prose and verse.
Yeah. I mean, poetry to me is a very private, personal endeavor. And I look to it because I feel like when I'm reading other people's poems, I'm reading because it feels like they're whispering about existence of some sort. And I want to hear what they have to say about this existence or that existence, you know. And then again, maybe it's a bit of trusting your reader to do the work to find the poems and to connect with other experiences, because poetry itself is not a quick process. It's a very slow thing, I think. I think people can do it quickly, and I don't understand how they do it quickly. Like, it's just not been my experience, but the world is loud and fast and harsh. And I don't know how you tell people to just take a breath.
I think, like everything else, there have always been people who want to go fast, and there are those of us who want to slow down. And there will always be someone looking for that, like, strange little niche thing that, you know, might be what poetry becomes. Or, I mean, let's be real.
It's
it is now.
Yeah, exactly.
But I remember many, many years ago at this point, when Kindle started to come out, I was like, oh, that's it. No more bookstores, you know? And I was really sad, and I lamented that. And it turned out that people didn't really go the way that the predictions wanted them to go. And there are more independent bookstores now than there have been in 30 years. So I feel like this is all still up in the air. And we might surprise ourselves. I don't think art is going to go anywhere. What I'm hoping will be the result of AI-driven prose and verse. I feel like what's going to happen is people will just become more creative.
Well, the thing with poetry and the written word is there's a risk. There's a risk there, and mm-hmm. there isn't a risk with AI. It's not risking anything by putting anything out, but it is a risk to put a book together of stuff that's sitting around in your existence. You know, whether it's true or not, it's still a risk.
The two of you are talking about an artistic act that connects with an audience mm-hmm. as opposed to something that gets out there and tries to outsell mm-hmm. something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, very good point.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, I think that any sense of like consumerism to me it's not really part of art. It becomes a tangential effect, but I don't know that it has too much to do with the creation itself.
Well, speaking of creations and your art, where could people find more of your work?
You are the one who is the exciting thing here.
Well, I mean, your exciting thing is... okay. Well, I have a book coming out this summer. My first collection of poetry is coming out summer of 2024. So it's called Throttle Body, and it's coming out by Get Fresh Books. So
my stuff is... my book is out of print, so that's a bummer. But most of my... I'm pretty private. I don't have any social media. So I don't, again, trying to preserve my creative headspace, right? That's how I keep the room in my brain. I have not actively sought publication in a long time for various reasons. So for me, I'd say read Lisa Alexander's poems. That's what I'd say.
Well, you do readings, though.
I do readings.
You do readings.
Yeah.
You've been doing readings for years.
Yeah,
so you can find her around the city.
Well... that was us talking about poetry in Pittsburgh, the Mad Women in the Attic, and poetry in life in general with Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
It was a real pleasure.
Once again I had the dream. I tossed
and I turned. That old feeling's still the same. It was so real. I woke up cold and sweating. I wonder, did I call her name? In the dream, she was right there with me. Right there with me in the bed. She said, Bobby, come and kiss me. But when I reached out to hold her, oh, I woke my wife instead.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
And we're back, folks.
Fellas, look who just walked in the door. That's Lonesome James King.
Well, thank you, David. Good to be here. Lonesome Owen Saunders is up there getting his fiddle. He'll be down here in just a little bit. But right now, I'd like to do that song me and you was rehearsing the other week. We was fooling around. I'd like to get together and do it if you want to. Remember that? I keep my love with you.
Glad you said it.
Yesterday, someone told me